The system is definitely broken. We're kind of entering a suddenly stage. They have to continue to print money and grow the money supply at a fast enough rate to keep the credit structure from collapsing. We are in an inflationary world. That means to me is at the margin right now, I'm selling gold and buying Bitcoin. And Bitcoin will, on this next run, go to 150, 200, 250, sometime within the next year. So we've never really had a financial asset like that before. So a higher price does not change the supply. Savers who are saving in the wrong currency just get totally wiped out. You know, prices get incredibly high. You know, everyone lives kind of hand to mouth. I mean, there's going to be an enormous, enormous wealth transfer here. 5 or 10 years, you know, you're going to know who owns sound money and who did not. So if we think of fiat as being kind of the Titanic and it's sinking, do you want to own a seat or don't you?
What do you think could get in the way of Bitcoin succeeding? Welcome back to G'day Bitcoin. I'm your host, Sean. Join us today is my dear friend, Lawrence Lepard, author of the amazing number one best-selling book, The Big Print. Lawrence is a sound money advocate, investment manager, anti-federalist, and just an all-round good guy. Larry, welcome back to the show. How are you?
It's great to be back with you. You're one of my favorite podcasters, and as you, we've really built up this friendship from afar. I mean, you're on the other side of the world, but it's wonderful what this technology allows. I'm not sure it's really a bestseller. The sales have been great. We sold 40,000 plus books, coming up on 45, but I don't think that makes it a bestseller. But it's in the Bitcoin community, it's been well received. And hopefully it's I designed it as a tool to help people. And I've heard stories that it is doing that in some cases, and that's very satisfying.
We're talking just before we hit record, and this book's had such a special place in my life. I've said the story on the channel a couple of times, but my wife, I've been in Bitcoin for 6 years and I'm a voracious reader, and every book of Bitcoin that I've read, I'd like hand to her. I'm like, sweetie, darling, you've got to read this. And she'll like open a little bit and she's like, nah, I'm not interested. Or she'll just like blatantly like, I'm not reading that book. 5 years later, after getting in and trying to give her every book, we're going on a road trip and I blackmailed her into listening to the audiobook read by Walker. And I just said, I'm not going if you don't listen to it. And she's like, all right, like eventually, yes. And so we started going down there, listening to it on the trip down to Ballarat, New South Wales, and we were coming back up. And at the last, there's 3 hours remaining, like a couple of minutes. And she just starts crying and I'm like, pull over, car and caravan, stop on the side of the road. And I'm like, sweetie, darling, what's wrong? And she's like, I didn't get it. I thought you were crazy. I thought this was just like magic internet money. And it was like some get rich quick or something. Like, I thought you were a bit crazy. She's like, you saved me. You saved our family. Like, thank you so much. And I'm like, no, like, thanks Larry so much. And she's like, where was this book 4 years ago? I'm like, I tried to give you every other book, but she's like, where was this book 4 years ago? I'm like, you've read it now and you get it. And then I was talking to her last night and she just said to say thank you so much, Larry.
Thank you. Really, hearing stories like that just really, that's very, very satisfying, because that's why I wrote it. I just feel like a lot of people are going to get hurt in this monetary event, and I felt like I was in a position to explain it in a way that people would understand. And there's not a lot of original thought in there. I leaned on Safe and Lynn and a lot of other great Bitcoin people. But maybe what I brought to it, I think, was a way of telling it in a sense that anyone could understand. And it's interesting, you mentioned that about your wife. I did the same thing with my wife. In fact, she inspired one of the chapters, the chapter on skepticism. And I said, you've got to read this, because, and I want to make sure you understand it, because nice. You're my target audience. I want somebody who doesn't know anything about Austrian economics or monetary issues or anything to understand. It was pretty funny. One of the first things she said, I didn't get very far into it. She read a couple of chapters. She says, what's the Federal Reserve? And I was kind of like, right? I mean, there are a lot of average citizens who don't know what the Federal Reserve even is. And so I thought, well, I got to describe that, right? So I tried to write it from a first principles, easy to understand basis, but I also try to put enough information in there to really support the case. I mean, it's not a lightweight book. It's got the data to support it. So yeah, it's thank you. Tell your wife I love her and I really appreciate the support. I've heard other stories like that. It's very satisfying as an author to hear that kind of stuff. Even if I don't sell a ton of books, as long as it makes a difference for some people, that's great.
The book only came out at the start of the year, and you're kind enough to send me the manuscript, and I got it New Year's Eve here in Australia. I started reading on New Year's Day. and I couldn't put it down, is I printed it like so tiny. So I was like holding these papers like this for 2.5 days. But by the 3rd of January, I'd finished the book and I was just like, oh, wow, this is amazing. And then it came out shortly after. And since there, I've handed out more of this book, The Big Print, than any other Bitcoin book. And I'm a reader and I like giving people books. So it's just amazing. But for everyone, it's literally the best book on Bitcoin to orange pill someone. It's in the description. Buy a heap of copies, hand them out. And one thing I've been saying to people, I'm like, if you read it front to back cover, I'll shut up about Bitcoin. If you're like, Bitcoin's not for me, once you've read it, that's cool. At least you know enough to be able to say, no, I'm not interested or whatever. And I've had quite a couple of people, not a lot of people, be not interested, but there was one guy, Jeff Wilson from Wilson Asset Management, big asset management firm here in Australia. And he read it or listened to it. And he's like, I get it. I understand and stuff. He's like a little bit older. It's just not for me. I'm like, cool. That's okay. I don't need to keep going over and over and rehashing the same thing. But if someone's just like, not interested in Bitcoin, I'm like, based on what? Like, have you read any of the books? And they're like, nah, I've watched TV or anything like that. So flipping the conversation to Bitcoin and why we're talking about Bitcoin and why you wrote a book on Bitcoin, we see gold at all-time highs, about $4,110 this morning. Silver is at all-time highs. Yeah, it looks like silver is just going crazy. There's this huge, big wick up. So I'd like you to talk about that. And Bitcoin, you know, it's just come down from the all-time highs, but it's still at about $115,000 over the weekend. At time of recording, we saw the biggest liquidation in crypto Bitcoin history. It feels like the system's broken, Lawrence, in every area. What's going on?
Yeah, well, the system is definitely broken, and I think what we're observing is the move from, you know, they say how you go bankrupt, you know, gradually and then suddenly. I mean, I think we've had the gradually stage for a number of years now. I think we're kind of entering a suddenly stage. And, you know, gold is more widely distributed, more widely known. Bitcoin's still emerging. And so, you know, it tends to smell out monetary debasement first and move first. You know, the gold move this year has really been unprecedented, you know, up 70-80%. And, you know, that's just, there are only a couple of years in history where it's ever moved that much, and they've indicated serious monetary distress. And of course, silver, same story. And actually, silver for some time was dormant, and now it's caught up and it's moving even more than gold percentage-wise. And that's the typical pattern in these bull markets for precious metals. Gold starts and then silver follows even harder. And, you know, it's really just symptomatic, I think, as we were talking about before we started recording, Sean, that more and more people are becoming aware of what the book describes, which is that the fiscal situation for the U.S. government is very bad. They have to continue to print money and grow the money supply at a fast enough rate to keep the credit structure from collapsing. And that means implicitly that we are in an inflationary world. And, you know, at the end of the day, when push comes to shove for the U.S. federal government, you know, they will print in order to prevent a deflationary collapse. And, you know, I named it the big print. Interestingly, there have been two big prints before this. The first one was 08, and the second one was COVID 2020. And I think the next one is coming. We're kind of slightly easing into it. Gold would indicate it's pretty close, pretty nearby. And my sense is it'll be even bigger than the last two. You know, I mean, there are recent indications of that. I mean, a data point that just popped up that, you know, I don't think anyone would have expected is that, you know, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent just agreed to bail out Argentina, you know, with $20 billion that we don't really have. But guess what? We can print it and give it to them on a swap line to try and stabilize their economy and hopefully get their currency to be stable. And we're doing that for geopolitical reasons, because we'd rather have them be in our fold rather than let China, you know, be in China's fold. So, you know, that's just one symptom of, or one example of how we're creeping toward that big print. Another example is that the Treasury has been selling short-term Treasury bills, short-term paper, but they've been turning around and using that to buy long-term paper, 10-year, 20-year, 30-year bonds. And that's to try and prevent those long rates from going higher, you know, and because they know that if the rates go higher, you know, that's going to lead to higher interest expense, bigger deficit, and the debt doom loop that we've described many times, you know, in podcasts and on Twitter. So I think it's just a recognition of the fact that there's no way out of this that doesn't involve serious inflation. And I think the most of the world knows that the best performing asset historically, the best performing asset inflation has been gold. And that's because we haven't really had a very serious bout of inflation since the 1970s. But when 2008 occurred, that's when I got radicalized for sound money and realized that the wealth I had earned was going to get debased severely because of what Bernanke was doing with QE and expanding the Fed balance sheet. And so the first thing I did is, okay, well, if we're going to have inflation, how does one protect oneself? So I went and I looked at historically, what are the best things to do in an inflationary environment? Well, the last real big inflationary environment, I was a teenager, it was the 70s. And there was a lot of inflation during the 70s, double digit for many, many years. And gold went from $35 to $800, and gold stocks did extremely well. And the two best performing assets in that decade were gold stocks and oil and gas stocks, both, you know, commodity related things that could not be printed. And so at that point in time, I realized, you know, that I basically wanted to pivot and start investing my capital in things that would be protected or would protect me from the inflation that I saw as inevitable. Now, you know, that was 08, so that was 15 years ago now, and there have been some ups and downs. It took some time, and my general thesis was right, but it didn't happen nearly as quickly as I thought it would. And so I was wrong on timing, but it now appears that we're pretty deeply into it. And, you know, I mean, people who invest in my fund always ask, well, what could go wrong, which is a very intelligent question. And I often think, you know, what could go wrong? And, you know, what could go wrong with the theme of the book and with the trade that I've made, and I have a lot of gold, I have a lot of silver, I have a lot of Bitcoin, is if the government got fiscally responsible, incredibly fiscally responsible. And I say that, and of course, most people laugh because we all know that given the way things are right now, that's not terribly likely. But, you know, unterribly likely things do happen, and eventually at some point that could happen. And when that happens, you know, these won't be such a good investment. When and if that happens, these won't be such a good investment. But until I see signs that they're going to means test Social Security, cut defense spending, et cetera, you know, I'm very confident we live in an inflationary world. And therefore, I want to own forms of money that can't be printed by the government, because I think the government's going to print a lot of money. So that's how we got to where we are, in my view.
Do you think it's like, even if they decided to be fiscally responsible, is it even mathematically possible where we are now with the state of debt in the world?
That's a really great question. I mean, there's an argument that it's not even mathematically possible, because if they got fiscally responsible, then all the money they're spending would not go into the economy would collapse, the debt couldn't be repaid, to get incredibly deflationary, then they'd have to print money. I mean, you make a very good point, which is that we may be so close to the brink that they can't bring it back. And I don't dispute that. I mean, the book talks about it, and the solution to this problem, there are several possible endpoints here. One of them is hyperinflation. That's not my base case, it's a tail case, but it's out there as a possibility. I think a more likely event is that inflation will get worse for a number of years and people will be screaming about it. And eventually we will elect sound money politicians who will do a one-time devalue reset, similar to what Roosevelt did in the 30s. And so at that point in time, hopefully we return to a sound money standard. I'd like to see it be a Bitcoin standard, but gold would be better than what we've got right now. And maybe it could be some hybrid of gold and Bitcoin as the monetary standard. And, you know, the inflation will stop. I mean, just like that. And if you study hyperinflations in other countries in the world, they're incredibly painful events. But interestingly enough, when they're over, if the country then returns to sound money, things get healed relatively quickly and the economy rebuilds. I mean, people want to wake up every morning, go to work, support their families, live normal lives. And, you know, if the money's broken, that's hard. If the money's sound, you know, you can do it. And so it's just as simple as realizing the problem here is that fiat money is a really broken thing, kind of reaching the end of its natural lifespan. And we need to move away from that. We need to move back to sound money if we want to enjoy the benefits that, you know, we enjoyed when we were on a sound money standard. I mean, you know, throughout the early 1900s and all the way up until, you know, 71, things weren't perfect, but they were better than they are now, inflation-wise. That's kind of the, you know, the where I think we're going.
If you've still got your Bitcoin on exchange, or you're looking to take your Bitcoin security to the next level, I've partnered with the Bitcoin Way. They offer live help for setting up cold storage, running your own node, keeping your Bitcoin private, planning for the future, using multi-sig, and so much more. They never touch your keys. They will not touch your coins. Instead, they'll show you how to buy and keep them safe. If you want to make your Bitcoin setup safer, you can book a free 30-minute call and have a chat with them. Safe Dina Moose, the author of the Bitcoin Standard, Natalie Brunel, Preston Pish, and so many more recommend the professional IT cybersecurity team. Couple of outstanding things here. You can see they've been featured in Forbes, Bitcoin Magazine, Bitcoin Prague, Zero Hedge, Simply Bitcoin, the Bitcoin Safe Dean, the Bitcoin Standard podcast with Safe Dean Amuse, Bitcoin News, obviously G'day Bitcoin for a long time. They're the world experts in helping people become self-sovereign. It's not just about protecting your Bitcoin stash. Yes, they will help you do that in a very easy to understand step-by-step process. But from there, they can help you secure your data. They are your personal cybersecurity IT experts. And then step number three is getting a second passport, a Plan B residency. The team, very cheap, very affordable for people that are looking to take their sovereignty to the next level. You can find out more about their services. When you first log in to their website as well, they have got a free 3-minute quiz to allow you to check if you are doing your cybersecurity, your setup correctly. I urge everyone to jump onto the bitcoinway.com. I have put a link into this description for everyone. Could not recommend them enough. I've used them personally before I ever partnered with them for the channel, friends and family. They asked me to help them out. I'm like, go to the world experts. That is the Bitcoin way. So reach out to the Bitcoin way today. One thing on that, like in my own life, and I dare say yours as well, from saving in Bitcoin like every 2 weeks for the last 5.5 years, I can see that my purchasing power is getting greater and stuff. And I just feel safer saving in that infinite, scarce, hard money, which is Bitcoin. You know, if there wasn't Bitcoin, I'd probably be saving gold. And I say all this because I feel like I'm safe within my life. And I think you are as well. And that's why a lot of Bitcoiners buy what we do, just buy a stack and chill and just get as much in self-custody. Do we really need the state to reset onto a sound money standard, or could we just all be on a sound money standard for things to get better if it was to get really bad? Everyone just opts out?
Well, like, yeah, that's a great question. I mean, in theory, we could do it, but as long as they're telling us that, you know, fiat money is legal tender, I mean, you know, what you're describing is if we don't have a reset, you know, what eventually will happen is, you know, fiat money will trend towards its intrinsic value, which is zero. But, you know, that's also hyperinflation. And that's, you know, if you look at historically when that occurs, I mean, that's not pretty. That's societally, that's a very, very difficult thing. You know, savers who are saving in the wrong currency just get totally wiped out. You know, prices get incredibly high. You know, everyone lives kind of hand to mouth. I mean, and it's interesting because, you know, Americans and to a degree Brits and Aussies aren't so familiar with this because we've generally speaking have had responsible monetary authorities the last couple hundred years. The people who get this the best, interestingly enough, are South Americans or Africans or people in the Middle East or, you know, Turkey. I mean, countries that have crappy currencies and have had hyperinflations or very, very high inflations. These people are much more aware of the risk. You know, that one day you can think you're worth a lot of money, but your money can get enormously devalued very quickly. I mean, interestingly enough, even Argentina, which we're bailing out, you know, they just, I mean, the Argentinian peso just lost like 30 or 40% of its value in 6 months, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, imagine that. Of course, that's not that unusual. That happened to us in COVID, right?
That's right.
Yeah. I mean,
same here in Australia.
Yeah. I mean, my grocery bill went up more than 40% after COVID. You know, and that's, it's interesting that kind of tracks very nicely with the amount that the money supply grew, you know, and so that's, you know, that's for a fiat system. That's not a bug. That's a feature. That's the way it works. And, you know, they're just because Powell came in, put rates up, they stopped the money supply growth briefly. You know, M2 is now growing again. It's now actually at a record high. And, you know, there will be stresses in the system that will cause them to ramp up the printing as we go forward. The book talks about what those stresses are. And, you know, we can see some of them. I mean, let's talk a little bit about what's going on, you know, in the U.S. macro picture right now. I mean, you know, President Trump gets elected and he intelligently realizes that the deficit's a problem, Good call. He creates the Department of Government Efficiency. Good call. He puts Vivek and Elon in charge of it. Arguably a good call. You know, Elon says he can cut $2 trillion. Well, that was a little unrealistic. And he said he could cut $1 trillion. Well, that's a little unrealistic too. They get in there and they find some really stupid programs and they do cut those. Okay. And so I don't know. There are a lot of debates about how much DOGE, what the Department of Government Efficiency named DOGE, has actually cut in terms of the U.S. federal deficit. And it's, you know, arguably it's $50 billion to $150 billion on a deficit of 1.8. Okay, well, that's a positive. But of course, Trump has a falling out with Elon. Vivek goes to run for governor of Ohio. And, you know, DOGE kind of more or less fails. It fails at balancing the budget anyway. Then he pushes through the tariffs, which have created additional tariff income. And that's a positive thing, adding probably $200 of revenue to the federal, you know, accounts. But then at the same point in time, you know, they go out and they pass the big, beautiful bill, which is a spending bill that arguably is going to increase spending between, you know, $3 and $5 trillion over 10 years. So that's $300 to $500 billion per year. So 200, you know, you save, say, let's say you save 100 from DOGE. Let's say you save 200 because you've got higher tariff income. Then you turn around and your big, beautiful bill spent the 300. So in reality, you're just not making any progress on the deficit. And the deficit this year just came in at $1.8 trillion. It would have been higher than that, but they actually changed some of the accounting rules. I mean, if they'd left them the way they had been, it would have been 2.1. But isn't it amazing they figured out a way to make it come in flat?
It's like inflation and CPI numbers.
Or the employment numbers. I mean, right? I mean, the government statistics are phony as the day is long, as we all know. So they really have not been able to balance the budget. And this is in a economy where the stock market has held up and employment's been okay, although it seems to be a bit soft. And as we know, if we have a downturn, it's your point is, you know, if they really try to bring through austerity, you know, well, that's going to lead to a big economic slowdown. The last two slowdowns, we're running a 7% of GDP budget deficit, which is high. And in the last two slowdowns, it grew by, you know, that amount or more in one of them, almost that amount in the other. So, you know, the problem is when you're, you know, it's, we're like this family that's got, you know, a lot of credit card debt and we're taking out new cards to make the minimum payments on the old cards. And, you know, the solution for that family generally would be to go bankrupt, you know, or to reach an agreement with their creditors and say, well, I can't pay all that. I'll pay back 30 cents on the dollar and that's better than nothing. And, but we can't do that or we haven't done that. And so, you know, off we go further and further. And this is why as more and more people come to see it, they're selecting things. They know that they can see the trap the government has put itself in. And they know that the politicians will not adopt the painful solution of austerity. And so they understand that we will print somehow, somewhere. And so they're front running that. That's what gold is doing. And what's interesting to me is that we see a period right now that really reminds me very much of 2019, 2018, 2019, 2020. Where, and I know some of the Bitcoiners are kind of frustrated. They're like, hang on a second, gold's really doing great. And silver is too. Where's ours? Well, first thing I would say is, remember, Bitcoin's still up, you know, 80, 90% year over year, which is pretty damn good. And two, gold typically moves first and Bitcoin follows. I fully expect that, you know, right now the gold-Bitcoin ratio is kind of up against this lower trend line. And what that means to me is at the margin right now, I'm selling gold and buying Bitcoin. Because I think Bitcoin's about to move next and catch up quickly. And historically, Bitcoin, as we know, has outperformed gold massively. And so, you know, in my view, you know, Bitcoin will, on this next run, go to, you know, 150, 200, 250, you know, sometime within the next year. And by the way, I think during that time frame, gold will probably go 4,500 or 5,000. On a percentage basis, I mean, if Bitcoin goes to 250, you know, that's up 100% in the next year. And I don't think gold is going to double in the next year. I don't think it's going from 4 to 8. I ultimately think both of these things will be much, much higher in fiat terms. I mean, it's a funny problem, Sean. I mean, we talk about this and I say, you know, because I know, I believe Bitcoin's going to $1 million and gold's probably going north of 10,000. And that's, you know, that's the good news for those of us who've invested in them. But the thing I caution is that, yeah, okay, fine. But that will be with a lot of inflation. So, you know, what would, as I call it, gasoline, as you call it, petrol. I mean, what will that cost? You know, what will beef cost? I mean, if you've got $1 million Bitcoin, fine. But you know, remember, the cost of everything you have to purchase is going to be higher too, because there's going to be a lot of inflation to get there. So, you know, but all we can really do, and as you said, you know, you feel very comfortable. I think one of the great things about being a Bitcoiner, about understanding this, And I watched my father retire with a fixed amount of money and watch it dwindle away as inflation ate at it and he got older, is that you actually kind of feel like you're not losing the rat race. I mean, if you save in this money, you know that over time you will get richer and it will protect you. And those are legitimate savings that you can rely on in your later years. And that just knowing that is an enormous sense of comfort to me. Like most human beings, one of your great fears, particularly as you age and you have less ability to earn money, is that you're going to run out of money. You know, it's a bummer.
100%.
You don't want to run out of money. And if you've got a form of money that's keeping pace with inflation or even beating inflation, as Bitcoin really is, I mean, I think gold is designed and has historically kept pace with inflation. If you put your money in gold, you're not going to lose money compared to inflation. Like Bitcoin is going to outstrip inflation because you've still got the adoption curve going on. You know, it's gold that everyone doesn't understand yet. And, you know, I read this morning that it's still only about 4.5% of the world owns some Bitcoin or gets it. So we got a long way to go. I mean, this is the Jesse Myers chart where there's 900 trillion of assets out there and Bitcoin is worth 2 trillion or 2.1 trillion, something like that. So that's 0.2%. And yet it's, you know, the best performing financial asset of the last 16 years. And it's the hardest financial asset on a stock to flow basis. It's harder than gold. And every 4 years, it gets harder still. So the combination of that and the fact that this adoption curve is going to keep going, and in 10 years, half the country is going to own Bitcoin, you know, there's no place for this price to go except for up. And that's another point that I would try to make, is that Bitcoin was the invention. It was the invention of digital scarcity. I think the important thing to understand about that is that, and it's a commodity. One Bitcoin's the same as another. So the important thing to understand on this is that every other commodity in the world, if the price goes up, we make more of it. You know, if oil goes skyrocketing, we'll drill for more oil. Wheat, we'll plant more wheat. You know, anything out there. Gold, we'll mine more gold. It takes time, but we'll mine more gold. Algorithmically, the supply of Bitcoin is fixed. And so we've never really had a financial asset like that before. So a higher price does not change the supply. And I don't think most people have gotten their head around that. And once you get your head around that, you realize that no matter what price you pay, it's not too high. And I know you've handed out the book. Yeah, at the time, right. I mean, you've got to wait, but I mean, I've handed out the book to many people. I've had many friends come to me and they say, hey, I get it. I'm happy for you. You bought it cheaper. You've made some money. That's all good. I say, yeah, I'm not selling. And they say, well, you know, I can't buy it now. It's too expensive. And I say, well, yeah, but in 5 years when it's a million, aren't you going to wish you bought it at, you know, 112? And they're kind of like, well, yeah, but I don't know if it's going to a million. I try to explain to them why I think it is. And, you know, a model I've used and I've talked about a lot, I think it's a useful model, is, you know, fiat in my book is failing. And that failure is becoming more obvious. It's accelerating. So if we think of fiat as being kind of the Titanic and it's sinking, and then we think of gold and silver as being lifeboats that, you know, that won't sink because they're sound. You know, yeah, I bought some lifeboat seats a lot cheaper 3 or 4 years ago. And I'm sure, look, when I bought mine, I wish I was Max buying his at $2 a coin, right? But whatever. But I bought them because I believed, you know, I understood what it was. You know, now the seat to you is more expensive, but you're on the Titanic. Do you want to own a seat or don't you? You know, and so I try to get all the people I talk to and say, look, okay, you think it's magic internet money, you're worried about security, you're worried about hacking, you know, all the various things, quantum computing, all the FUD. Fine, I'm not suggesting you take 100% of your net worth and put it in this, but to have zero, you're really missing a very, very asymmetric bet. Because I'm highly confident this thing will go up 10x within a kind of a 6-year window, and another 10x after that in the following 10 years. So, yeah. You know, that would make it $10 million a coin. So, And then finally, the last piece is I try to explain, you don't have to buy a whole coin. A lot of people don't get that. I have a lot of people say, well, I don't have $112,000. I know you don't. That doesn't matter. You know, I mean, I have friends. I know my kids. I mean, they DCA 50 bucks a week. You know, I mean, you can buy it at, you know, you can buy any amount of it in small amounts and just do it consistently. And 5 years from now, I think you'll be, your future 5-year out self will thank your current self that you did it. So
one thing that I've been saying to people, like directly in regard to that point, I'm like, the way that I'm thinking about it, because I also believe that one Bitcoin will be about $1 million in the next 5 years, give or take, whatever, but roughly in that time frame. And then the 5 to 10 years preceding that, about $10 million as well, US. And so I say, like, work out what your weekly expenses are. Maybe it's $1,000 a week to be able to live. Maybe it's $2,000 a week to be able to live comfortably. I'm like, for every $100 you're saving now, today, that's $1,000 in 5 years. So if it's $1,000 for 1 week to be able to live, it's costing you $100 today to buy back a week of your life in 5 years' time. And they're like, oh, yeah. I'm like, if you extrapolate that out to when Bitcoin's at $10 million, that $100 is $10,000. Obviously, the purchasing power and stuff like that. Maybe it's only half that amount or whatever, but you can buy a little bit.
Yeah, there'll definitely been some inflation, but you will beat it by a lot. Yeah.
For sure. And then just getting them into that mindset, you can just buy a little bit, and it's just about buying like a week of your future back in time. And that's really what I see money as. Going back a little bit, you said Bitcoin adoption's at 4.5%. That's actually a little bit surprising, maybe a little bit higher than what I think, because 4 to 5 people out of every 100 that I talk to don't hold Bitcoin. And I talk to a lot of people trying to get them to read the book. But I believe it's 3.5% of people in a movement is needed for a revolution. So it seems like we're over that tipping scale, and then Bitcoin's also over a $2 trillion market cap as well. I don't know if we've ever seen a $2 trillion anything really fail now. And then even like with the biggest liquidations over the weekend, $19 billion or whatever, it's just starting to bounce back up. What do you think could get in the way of Bitcoin succeeding? Like lately, over the last year, we don't need to go into the details, but there's been like the node wars, Knot's first core, etc. But is there any like foreseeable risk you can see to Bitcoin as a money or a network? Or
no, I really don't. I mean, yeah, Knot's versus core is annoying. I don't think it's an existential threat, because it's really not a protocol change. It's more something on the side. It's annoying though, because it could balloon the size of the blockchain and it would be harder to run a node. I mean, also it's annoying because of the way the core developers have behaved. I think some of them have behaved in a very immature fashion, which, you know, is not befitting of what Bitcoin really is. But setting that aside, and that's, you know, that when I asked Michael Saylor once, what's your major concern about this thing? He said, well, I just hope Core doesn't go rogue and do stupid shit. But even if they do stupid shit, everybody gets to vote on it. And so, you know, if they do something really stupid, I don't think most people will go in that direction. You know, I guess the thing I could see that I keep my eye on, I do think it's relevant, is, as you recall, before Trump was elected, the blue administration here was not very friendly to Bitcoin or crypto in general.
That's probably not shit.
Right. You know, politics are politics. And so in 28, there'll be another election for president. And Trump can't run, but J.D. Vance probably will. And I don't know what'll be going on. There might be very high inflation. There'll be all kinds of trouble in the country. And, you know, the Democrats might cook up some cock and bull story where it's like, okay, you know, we're going to give you all stimulus. And, you know, this inflation is a factor of this existing, you know, administration. And we can fix it, even though they can't. And, you know, they're going to tell a bunch of lies. And people are going to be hurting, you know, with high inflation. And for all we know, at the margin, they're going to win. And I'm not saying that's going to happen. I'm just saying it's a possibility. And then, you know, if they get in there, they're going to probably take a much more hostile view towards this. I think, you know, we had a pretty good Keynesian model here going, and we liked the way things were. And this gold and Bitcoin stuff, it's really messing us up. We need to either tax it or confiscate it or, you know, regulate it or, you know, they've already talked about trying to pass some rules where you'd make it illegal to self-custody this stuff, which is just outrageous.
Crazy.
And so those, you know, I feel like we've got 3 years of real open running space where that kind of administration in the U.S. is not likely to occur. But, you know, this is why people ask me about the ETFs versus self-custody. I mean, I think by that time, we'll see who's going to win. You know, for all we know, Trump will have done a reset by then. I mean, DeSantis talked about the need for a monetary reset akin to what they did at Bretton Woods in 1944. But if the reset has not happened and red team looks like they might lose and blue team is coming in, and, you know, I mean, blue team was talking about taxing unrealized capital gains. I mean, unfortunately,
I want to talk about that because that's a big topic in Australia.
Is it? Yeah. I mean, now fortunately, you know, the beautiful thing about self-custody Bitcoin is that, you know, I mean, if you view the law as being unfair and you know, you're willing to break it, you know, you can tell the government to go pound sand. I mean, how much Bitcoin do I have? I'm not telling you. You know, pay taxes on it? I'm not telling you. They can't get at it. If you've got your words, you know, short of torturing those words out of you, they can't get you. But boy, they could make life really unpleasant for you, I would imagine. You know, and I mean, there's even a scenario where I would imagine Bitcoiners, U.S. Bitcoiners might say, hey, you know what? I don't need to live here anymore.
Yeah, I'm out.
Bitcoin was designed for that. You know, you move to El Salvador, you take your keys, you got your money, you live happily ever after. So, you know, I think that's a legitimate risk. I mean, if you want to hear my model, I was just at a thing called Camp Nakamoto this weekend. We were all sitting around the campfire kind of talking about what might unfold. I mean, and my model is actually that we're going to have another good run here. You know, the next 3 years will be good for Bitcoin. We'll have high inflation. And that somehow the Democrats will figure out a way to win that next election, and they will print like crazy, and we will trend toward hyperinflation. And they might do some of these bad things I've talked about. And then at that point in time, the pain will be so large that everyone will scream, you know, we've got to fix this problem. And I think at that point in time, what will happen is Michael Saylor will run for president, and he will come in with a master plan, an engineer's view of what went wrong and how to fix it. And things will be bad enough that he'll win. And we will actually then migrate to a sound money standard. We'll have a Marshall Plan for nuclear power development. We'll denuke the entire world. We'll have peace treaties with everybody. And quote unquote, this quote, fourth turning will be over, and we'll live in a new, beautiful, abundant age. So that's my optimistic scenario of how we get out of that. And that would be, let's see, he would be elected sometime in 2032 election. So, you know, because the Democrats would have 4 years and they'll just make it unbearably bad. And that will set it up for him to win. By that time, he'll be the world's richest man. He's already said he's going to give his keys away. So my suspicion is, you know, people say, well, he's not doing this for the money. He's already rich. He's actually doing it because he's an American. He's a patriot and he wants to save the world, which I think he does. I think he's a good guy. So that's my optimistic case of where we go. But, you know, 2032 is quite a few years from now. And so, you know, we've got to go through the, you know, the pain of the inflation that gets us there.
That's such an amazing rabbit hole to go down. We may come back to it.
Okay. But I know that was out of the blue, right? But I just thought it was on my mind and I just talked about it. And I'm an optimist. I'm very much an optimist that this world is going to get a whole lot better on the other side of it, you know?
I agree. And I think like one by one in people's own lives, saving in Bitcoin, it can get better.
Oh, yeah.
Quicker.
Yeah, yeah.
And then as the nation states move over. So a couple of things, like we are seeing as like the Luxembourg Sovereign Wealth Fund, they add 1% of the 900 million portfolio to the Bitcoin ETFs. Like all around the world, obviously El Salvador, what Michael Saylor is doing with MicroStrategy. It's not like when you say things like that, they're unfounded or they're baseless. It feels like the world is starting to wake up and start to hoard as much Bitcoin as possible. Some people are far, far ahead. Obviously, Michael Saylor with Strategy and what he's done there, he's like well ahead of the curve. But it seems like, all right, like people with a little bit of common sense or that are like really paying attention to the problem are starting to see that Bitcoin is this amazing solution. Even, you know, Trump ran on this promise of the strategic Bitcoin reserve and stuff, and it sounded like he could understand it and he could see it and that this would be a good thing. But we're seeing sort of other nation states or private companies, individuals do this trade, but we haven't really seen it from the United States with the strategic Bitcoin reserve. Like they bought 20 billion in Argentine pesos before they bought a single Bitcoin. So like, how do you think that plays out?
Well, yeah, and I think we've all been frustrated by that. I mean, Senator Loomis's bill, you know, laid out a plan to buy a bunch, you know, and Bessent talked about doing it in a revenue neutral way. I mean, you know, sadly, they've probably got other priorities in front of it. I mean, for starters, if they don't sell any of the 200,000 coins they have, that's a start. You know, I would say that they will hopefully get to it. They'll come to the point where they start to buy it. And the sailor has said the first country that figures out how to print, you know, fiat to buy Bitcoin kind of wins. I think they're also aware, they know the dollar is failing. They need the dollar to be devalued, but they don't want to do it too quickly. They need a transition period. They need time. Going straight to full hyper-Bitcoinization / hyperinflation, that's dangerous and a mess in their mind. And they're probably right about that, but they're trending in that direction. I mean, I think there's some interesting data points too. So mostly, I don't know how many Aussies probably know this name, but there's a guy named Stephen Moran, who is the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors in the White House. He works for Trump And he's young. He's a Bitcoiner. I mean, he tweeted, in fact, this is my upcoming quarterly report, which will be free and out by probably by the time you publish this. So it's at my website for free. He tweeted, you know, I'm talking about some problem, and he tweeted, Bitcoin fixes this. Okay. Now, so this is a guy who's in, you know, we know Lutnick is positive. We know Kennedy is positive. We even know Bessent's positive. Bessent is a gold bug, but he's admitted that Bitcoin is digital gold. So we've got all these people around Trump who are very positive on sound money and arguably are talking about a reset. You know, how much Trump himself understands, a little unclear, but he's being advised by good people. And this Moran guy is very interesting because, you know, Trump has attacked the Federal Reserve, as we haven't discussed this, but as most people in Australia may have not seen it, but he's really attacked the Federal Reserve. I mean, he's called Jerome Powell a moron. He said he's too late. I mean, it's unprecedented.
Well, he wants to kick him out, doesn't he, next year?
Yeah, well, he's going to get kicked out. In May of next year, he's gone. His term ends and he will appoint somebody else. But, and, you know, he went after Lisa Cook, who's a woman who's on the Federal Reserve Board and claims she committed mortgage fraud. You know, pretty arguably she did, but that's in front of the Supreme Court, whether that justitutes cause for firing her. But he got lucky. This other Fed governor quit. And so there was an open seat and he put Stephen Moran, his council economic advisor, he put him on the Fed board. And, you know, this is a guy. So there's a Bitcoiner on the board of the Federal Reserve, right?
And I did not know this.
Yeah. Right. And so this guy is a Bitcoiner, full-fledged Bitcoiner. In the most recent Fed meeting, you know, Powell said, let's cut rates 25 bips. And Moran dissented and said, no, we should do it 50. And both Trump and Moran have said interest rates need to come down between 200 and 300 basis points. And of course, they need to do this, Sean, because if they take those rates down that low, that will lower the government's cost of borrowing, which will help with the deficit. Okay, that's the good news. The bad news is if they take rates down that low, you know, borrowing will increase, M2 will increase very rapidly, and it'll be highly inflationary. I mean, they haven't really solved the last bout of inflation, and yet they'd be cutting into the, you know, they'd be cutting, you know, in an inflationary environment. And so like the 70s, we would have another big upwave in inflation. But, you know, I think that's what they want. I mean, they know that they have to grow faster than the debt grows. They have to grow GDP faster than the debt grows. And the only way to do that is to have inflationary growth, you know. So that's kind of where they're going, and you can see it. I mean, they're talking about it. Bessent has said, you know, when Doge failed, he kind of said, well, yeah, you know, we've done the best we could there, but really the solution to this problem is we're going to grow our way out of it. Okay, fine. How do you get growth? You lower interest rates. And so, you know, Powell is there until May of next year, 26. But, you know, with the markets are forward looking. So it's October. May is not that far away, right? You know, 7 months or something. 8 months. And, you know, the market says, okay, you know, we get it. You know, when he's gone, you're going to put Moran in the Fed chair or some other guy in the Fed chair. You're going to direct him to cut rates a lot. And, you know, that's going to massively fuel inflation. And that's why, in my opinion, that's why gold and silver have the bid that they have. You know, the market can read the tea leaves of what's coming and are saying, okay, well, fine. You want to do that? That's fine. You know, we understand that, you know, these metals are a protection and we're going to buy them.
It sounds scary. I guess it'll be interesting for everyone holding Bitcoin or precious metals, hard assets. They're going to feel like they're getting wealthier and wealthier. But in that moment, for everyone not holding it, it's going to be a pretty hard transition.
It's going to suck. Yeah, it's going to really suck. It's going to be high inflation again. And it, you know, and it's for those holding metals in Bitcoin. I mean, I've got a lot of people, a lot of my investors, others are calling, say, well, gosh, it's gone up so much. Don't we sell now? And I'm like, well, yes.
What?
Yeah. And sell and buy what? You know what I mean? You're going to buy stocks. They're not cheap. You know, you want to hang out in the dollar or you want to buy T-bills and get 3% when, you know, inflation is going to be higher than that. I mean, there's really nothing to sell in favor of today. I mean, it's so I think. you know, the hardest thing to do is actually going to be to hang on to the positions you have, you know, because we're in kind of uncharted territory in this monetary reset.
Interesting times. And I guess, like, on that note, and to round out the pod, is I'm such a big advocate of Bitcoin self-custody. I believe not your keys, not your coins. I believe that after a while, everyone should be running their own node, becoming their own bank.
Absolutely.
Doing it properly for many reasons. But some people, they'll buy the ETF or they'll leave Bitcoin on the exchange, or they'll go into like a collaborative custody model with someone like Unchained or something like that. And I guess that's a bit better than leaving on the exchange or the ETF from my opinion. Then people go like even further out for what I consider the risk curve and be holding Bitcoin treasury companies where they've got no access to the underlying asset, full stop. What are your thoughts in regards to how one should approach Bitcoin? Is it just like buy and hold Bitcoin in self-custody, or is it nuanced for different people?
Look, it's different strokes for different folks, and there are flavors here. I mean, as you're aware, and many of your listeners probably are, I mean, self-custody is not simple. It's not incredibly hard, but it's not simple. But if you're, you know, 60 plus years old, not very technical, you know, you may not have the ability, certainly you wouldn't have the ability without some handholding perhaps, to figure out how to conduct self-custody, get a wallet, and get a hard wallet and take your coins off the exchange, et cetera. But it's doable. It's not impossible. It's just not simple. You know, I've always pilled many older people and they want exposure to the price. They're not really worried about the government grabbing their coins. And so they buy an ETF, and that's perfectly suitable. They'll get the price appreciation. I then say, okay, once you've got that, now you've started, you know, now you need to learn about self-custody. I don't think, as I think I said earlier, you know, I think with this administration, the risk of Bitcoin confiscation is very, very low. So, you know, you probably got a few years to learn self-custody. And so I wouldn't freak out if you haven't. I mean, I'm with you, not your keys, not your coins. And, you know, I'm principally self-custody, except for a few IRA accounts that I can't really move. But the ETFs are kind of a gateway drug. And you know, you're going to get the price appreciation. Your only risk there is that, you know, if the government, and it's true with Unchained or any of the others, if the government calls up and says, hey, you know, we are grabbing these things, paying everybody out in fiat, tell us who your customers are and send us the coins. Well, they're going to do it. They're not going to break the law. You know, men with guns would come and put them in jail. So that's certainly the risk. I don't rate it as a high risk today. That could change, as I said, with a blue administration. Regarding the Bitcoin treasury companies, let's talk about that. So the notion of a treasury company is pretty straightforward. You know, the purpose is to buy and hold Bitcoin. It's like a closed-end mutual fund in that respect, although they can issue new shares and use those new shares to buy Bitcoin too. In theory, they you know, all else being equal, they should kind of trade at the value of the underlying Bitcoin, even though the shareholder can't go and get the underlying Bitcoin. And closed-end mutual funds, sometimes they trade at a premium and sometimes they trade at a discount. Right now, a lot of them are the Bitcoin treasury companies are trading at a discount just because they haven't been particularly well managed and, you know, there was a frenzy and everyone got overexcited. But that's also leading to some of the better managed ones buying some of the poorly managed ones. But the reason that a treasury company exists and the reason there's actually a business model there, and I believe there really is, I own Strategy, I believe in Saylor, I believe in what he's doing, is that these companies can actually use the capital markets to arbitrage the difference between somebody who wants a 10% yield with no volatility and somebody who wants, you know, the volatility and growth of Bitcoin. And what do I mean? Well, I think Saylor with Strategy just created a product, the Stretch product, where he basically gives you a way to get a monthly dividend, you know, equal to somewhere between 10. I've heard he's going to increase it to 11, 12, but whatever. So let's call it 10% annually by buying his preferred. And that preferred is covered by, you know, the underlying Bitcoin he holds by, you know, a great ratio. And he will fund that dividend by either selling more equity or selling more preferred. And what he's, and the reason that it works for his shareholder is that he's paying 10%. He's using the capital you give him when you buy the preferred. He pays you 10% on that capital. He invests that capital in Bitcoin. He's giving you 10%. Let's say Bitcoin goes up at 30%, and that 20% spread is being captured by his shareholder. Now, if that spread disappears, if Bitcoin only goes up 10% and he's paying you 10%, well, then there's no value getting added. But if Bitcoin goes up more, he does better and vice versa. And I think the bet he's making is that he's quite confident the annual rate of return on Bitcoin for the next 10 or 15 years is north of 30%. And therefore, he's comfortable up until a point in selling these preferreds. Now, you know, as the coverage gets lower and people get more worried about, you know, downturn, well, perhaps, you know, he won't be able to sell more and he'll have to slow down. But right now, his leverage is not that high, you know, all things being considered. He's got a huge underlying base of Bitcoin. And, you know, he's basically allowing a boomer who wants 10%. It's very hard if you're a boomer and you're retired to get a 10% yield relatively safely. And yet I think this is a pretty safe instrument and it'll give you a 10% yield. And so what that's doing is he's kind of recycling a lot of capital kind of backdoor into Bitcoin. And he's raking off the piece that the boomer says, I'll give up the 20% in exchange for a guaranteed 10. And he's saying, great, I'll guarantee you the 10. Because my equity holders really like the volatility and they want the 20. Mm-hmm. And so it's a model that works and it's not crazy. Now, you know, the big question that everyone hasn't figured out yet, and I haven't either, is what multiple of underlying Bitcoin, what MNAV should these things sell at? And, you know, we've got them selling at 0.7 times MNAV, and at the high of point, you know, Metaplanet was selling at 8 or 9 times MNAV. Well, I'm pretty sure 8 or 9 times, I mean, there's value added in my opinion, just like a bank. A bank sells at higher than its book value because it has capital that it can deploy to earn a return. And so you don't just buy into a bank at its book value. But Strategy is kind of like a bank. It's just got assets and liabilities. And you're willing to pay something more than the underlying assets because they can use the underlying assets to generate yield. And so should that be a 1.2 multiple or 1.5 or a 1.7 or a 2.0? It's somewhere in there. It's somewhere between, in my opinion, between 1.6 and 2.1. You know, when all the treasury companies came out, there was a little bit of a flurry and everybody got really excited and everyone thought, oh, this is great. They're all going to grow like crazy. You know, they're selling new stock and adding to the Bitcoin per share. And therefore they deserve these enormous premiums. And I think that myth or thought pattern has kind of gotten dispelled, right? They don't deserve to sell it 4 or 5 times MNAV, no matter how quickly they're growing. But they do deserve to sell it more than MNAV because of the model I described, where they can earn more than their cost of capital. So it's just as simple as that. And in my view, the simplest way, if anyone wants to participate in that, is to participate with Strategy because of the first, the biggest. I think Saylor is very bright. I think they won't do stupid stuff. And I think they're very well managed. And I, you know, the way I look at my Strategy holding is I think it will outperform my Bitcoin holding over time, maybe by 50%. And yet I still have a vast majority of my assets in Bitcoin.
That's what I was going to ask. If someone was to go into it, could I keep it super simple, Larry? It's just Bitcoin and self custody.
Absolutely.
That's me. But say, is it like a 1% allocation, a 5% or a 10%? Like, I guess it comes down to people's risk. But
what you're looking for and how aggressive you want to be. I mean, I would recommend maybe 5 or 10. I mean, I'll tell you a story that kind of broke my heart because I know the guy's got to be hurting now. You know, back a while back, not that far back, when Metaplanet was soaring, and as we recall, it was up going straight up, you know, a young guy who, you know, looked at Bitcoin and said, well, yeah, it's returning 40% a year, but I want to make more, right? And he tweeted out and he said, hey, I'm selling all my Bitcoin to buy Metaplanet. And I was like, you know, I did a head.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, right? And I was like, you know, and if you look at what's happened to the price of Metaplanet, you know, he just had a pretty rough ride. Now, I think Metaplanet will come back, don't get me wrong. But the point is, you know, you got to be careful with these things. So they are leveraged Bitcoin. So, you know, Bitcoin's volatile. Well, guess what? Leveraged Bitcoin's even more volatile. And one of the things that last Friday taught us is that leverage is dangerous. When I was reading the comments on last Friday where, you know, we had this big rinse and wash, I couldn't believe it. You know, some of these brokers are still giving people 50-to-1 leverage. I mean, that's just, I mean, anyone who trades anything on anything greater than 10-to-1 leverage, that's insane. I mean, if you trade, you know, even 10-to-1 leverage, you get a 10% move, you're bankrupt. I mean, a 50-to-1 leverage, you get a 2% move. It's just insane. I don't know who's doing this stuff. And, you know, I think you see this a lot where people come into Bitcoin, they think it's a great asset. And then, but it's boring, you know, it's going up 30, 40% a year, maybe some years more, some years less. And they're like, well, yeah, okay, I want to get there faster. You know, I'm going to add leverage to it. Well, you know, it's a very unpredictable asset and it does have significant drawdowns. I mean, one of the things I always caution people when I give out my book or I talk to them about it is I say, hang on a sec, before you put anything into this, ask yourself, if this went down 50%, would you be tempted to sell it? Or would you be thinking, no, 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 this is on sale, I'm buying more? Because if you're thinking it's on sale, I'm buying more, well, then that's the right allocation. If you're thinking, oh my God, I got too much in this, I got to sell it, then you're overexposed. So, you know, that's, I think that's an important mindset that people have to have, because, you know, it has gone down. I mean, the last time it's gone down as much as 70%. I mean, I was buying pre-Sam Bankman-Fried at 60 and it went to 15. I didn't feel great about that, but I knew I was right. So I just hung on. It's come back. But yeah. The point is, and I don't think we're going to have any more 70% drawdowns, but gosh, we could easily have a 50% drawdown. I mean, my model says we go from 120, 112 to 240, and then we go from 240 back down to 110, you know, that we, right, that you know, and then we go from 110 to 400. You know, I mean, that's the nature of the beast. If you look at the pattern historically, it has these big up moves, and then it retraces them, and then it has another big up move. And, you know, it's higher highs and higher lows, so that if you can wait 5 years, you're always ahead. But guess what? You know, that's, you're not making these great returns. I mean, the price of that is volatility. And the good example of that is Amazon, the Amazon stock. I mean, it's up 212,000% from its IPO. And yet, you know, it's the leading online seller of goods. And yet, you know, it had multiple, one drawdown was 90% in the early days, and it had multiple 50 to 70% drawdowns. Now, it always came back. But, you know, you didn't get that great return without having volatility. And that's just true in investing in general.
Yeah, I love it. I want to say maybe two statements to round it out. But same with you, like when I hand the book or whatever, I'm like, the moment if you do decide to buy, just expect that it's going to drop. That's what's going to happen. It's going to go up until you buy, and then you're going to be like, oh, what have I done? Pretty much guarantee it. And then the second thing is just a mindset that I have on any given day for any reason, I expect a negative 36% drawdown. Like we've had so many in Bitcoin's history. Oh, yeah. So like I over the weekend, 10% down, I'm like, cool. Obviously the numbers are bigger and stuff, but you're like, whatever, this is just another day.
This one was a little tough and a little bit of a gut check. I mean, even for guys like me, I mean, as you recall, I think it was last week we hit a new all-time high of 126, didn't we?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's right.
Yeah. It's not that often that you get a breakout to a new all-time high and then, bam, a week later, kicked in the teeth, you know?
Yeah, 20K down.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, whoa.
That's your God candle.
Yeah, exactly, in the wrong direction. But, you know, I mean, that is just the nature of this beast. And those of us who've been in it since 2017, or I started in 2013 and 14, I didn't really get serious until 2017. You know, I've just come to accept that. I mean, I bet you find this hard to believe. But a lot of days I just don't even look at the price. I'm just like, you know, whatever. I mean, it's just not something I care about. So.
And I guess last thing, to your point where you're saying like self-custody, maybe for someone that's around your age, it can be a little bit harder or something unless you have somebody hold your hand. I don't know if you know Tony Yazbek from the Bitcoin Way. And they help people be able to learn.
Yep. Yes, there are a lot of people. I mean, you do it. Unchained does it. I mean, BTC Sessions has great videos on it. You know, I've done it with a lot of my clients. I mean, I have a lot of gold over clients, right? And they've gotten into Bitcoin. They're like, well, how do I do self-custody? And so, you know, I like Trezor. I said, well, you go buy a Model T from Trezor. And, you know, I'll do a Zoom call.
I don't like Trezor, but each their own.
Yeah. And I walk them through how to do it. And I mean, and it's scary at first. I mean, and you know, it's not a simple process. And you know, I set it up, put $100 on it, wipe it out, you know, restore it. I mean, you got to do that. It's like when you send your first crypto transaction, you're kind of like, oh my God, did I just lose that money? You know,
but send a little bit.
Yeah. So you send a little bit and you test it, and you know, anyone can do it, but you do have to, you know, go slowly. You know, start out with test small amounts and do it over and over again, and eventually you'll realize, you know what, this is very achievable and doable and manageable and not that risky.
I was talking to somebody the other day and I said exactly that. You just need to delete it, restore it. He's like, how many times? I'm like, till you get absolutely sick of it and then keep doing it until you just I can do it in your sleep. He's like, all right, like that's a lot of times. Well, I'm like, yeah, but you'll be thankful for it.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you know, do it every 3 to 6 months too, because you might forget the process. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, do it every, and, And I, by the way, my hard wallets, I mean, I always erase my hard wallets. I mean, I never leave a Trezor around with all the stuff loaded into it so that somebody could hold a gun and say, hey, transfer this money. I mean, whenever I start to think about moving a coin, I go back and re-input the 12 words, and start at scratch.
Yeah, I think it's something that great power comes great responsibility. You need to
That is really right. And it is scary, and it's not for everybody. I mean, there's some people who'd say, well, I just don't want to take that risk, and I'm gonna send mine to Fidelity, or I'm gonna send it to Unchained, or whatever it might be, and that's fine. I mean, I think you'd probably be fine. We hope so. I mean, I tell you what, if we get the wrong kind of government in place, there's going to be a wave of people swarming to folks that say, help me do self-custody now. I think we'll see, if we're going, I mean, these things don't happen instantly without some warning. So I think if things are going in a bad direction, I think we'll all see that. I mean, I've got several clients who are very much aware of that risk, who have their money on, in an ETF or on an exchange or with somebody like a river. And, they say, their view is kind of like, well, you tell me if you think the risk is coming and I'll get into the self-custody thing. But right now I don't want to mess with it. I'm like, okay. Fair enough.
At least they're exposed to Bitcoin, and that's the first start. Lawrence, I just want to hand the microphone over to you if there's a question that I didn't ask or a topic that you think is important to bring up and round out the show.
Yeah, no, not really. I'm trying to think of what else have we been talking about of late that's important. Look, I think it's a difficult and tricky time. I think the one thing that a lot of people are really missing is quote unquote the inflation risk. COVID was not a one-off. 2008 was not a one-off. They're coming more rapidly. They're larger with each one. There's another one coming. I call it the big print, the name of the book. And as a result of that, one has to protect oneself from inflation. I think there's going to be an enormous, enormous wealth transfer here, Sean. And 5 or 10 years, you're going to know who owned sound money and who did not. And the people who own sound money, gold, silver, Bitcoin, are going to be incredibly advantaged financially versus those who did not. I mean, go study some of these hyperinflations, how they happen. And, people who were rich and had all their money in bonds, they kind of get wiped out. And people who were average and had their money in gold, they became really rich in local currency terms. And so I think that's going to happen. I really, really think that's going to happen. And I really high level of confidence in that. And that's why I wrote the book, because I don't think, if you just get that basic principle right, you don't have to be a financial genius. You don't have to pick stocks. You don't have to worry about this stuff all along. You just have to kind of understand the basics and focus on the basics and save in sound money, and you'll be benefited from that. I mean, there are great stories in America. There's one story I really love of a guy who was a World War II veteran. He fought in the Pacific, and he was from LA, and he came back and he went to work in the machine tool shops of the aeronautics industry, which is all special around LA, and as they built all the airplanes to send us around. And so he probably never made more than a highly skilled machinist salary, which is a good salary, but not, you don't get wealthy doing that. But what he did, he understood the issue of sound money. And so he saved in coins, gold coins. So he was buying throughout all the 40s, 50s, and 60s, he was buying gold coins at $35. And he kept buying them in the 70s, and the 80s rolled around, the prices got higher. And then he passed somewhere in the mid 80s. This great story, and his kids never knew he was doing this. He lived in a modest house. And they went out in the garage, and he had all these old ammo boxes out there. And it turns out, and this was back when gold was at the time, I think it was only $500 or $600. It turns out the guy had $8 million worth of gold. So, wow. So here's a guy who basically spent his life saving in a sound currency, and the sound currency got the other currencies got debased, and turns out he was quite a wealthy man. And so that story is going to be repeated. There are going to be people who had just a modest amount of Bitcoin or a modest amount of gold, and they're going to, be kind of surprised at how wealthy they become as a result of the failure of the fiat currencies. And so, I think we all have to do that, and not in a greedy way, more in a just protect yourself way, guarantee your family's future. And I also just think, this is probably going to take 10 more years to play out, or 2025. I think we probably maybe probably see the failure of fiat in the early 2030s. That's kind of, that matches my fourth turning model. I mean, the fourth turning this time, in my view, is about money. And it started in 2008. And these things tend to last 20 to 30 years. So that puts the end point at 2028 to 2038. I don't think we'll make it to 2038. I think it'll fail before then. So my sense is in the early 2030s, we will have had currency failure and we will be on a sound money standard. And like I say, I think it's just going to blow people's minds. I mean, it'll be as if you were smart enough to buy Microsoft in the earlier days or buy, you know, Amazon in the earlier days or whatever it might be. I mean, you make just huge multiples of your money and be like, how the hell did that happen? Imagine Bitcoin at $2, $3, $4 million. Imagine Bitcoin at $20 million a coin. It's entirely possible. Now, yeah, at that level, gasoline will be $100, but you'll still be way ahead of everyone who didn't have any Bitcoin.
I think on that note, I literally, ladies and gentlemen, I cannot encourage you to read this book enough. It's truly amazing. You can get it off Amazon. Like, I live in Australia, the shipping's slow and it will still be shipped down like 2 to 3 days. Yeah. It's really good. It's one book, 3.5 hours. I promise you, I guarantee it will change your life for the person you pass it on to if they read it.
I wrote it to help average people, and I hope average...
It's so accessible.
Yeah, I hope they enjoy it. I try to keep the language simple. So,
it's really amazing. From the bottom of my heart, Lawrence, thank you so much for everything you do, the messages you put out.
I love being on your show and I love what you're doing and I really appreciate all your support. It means a lot.
It means a lot to me too. Fix the money, fix the world, ladies and gentlemen.
We will.
For everyone out there, if you haven't already, hit subscribe if we vibe, and then please do something nice for yourself today for somebody else out there. Be blessed. Peace.